Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
94.3 WYBC, the rhythm of this city. I'm Juan Castillo, and this is the electric drum. Now, this young man, I've been trying to get on electric drum for a while, Connecticut State Senator Gary Winfield, and I finally got him here this morning. We're going to talk about his life, and we're going to talk a little politics, but mostly about his life, man. This cat is a fellow New Yorker, and he's got a very, very inspiring story, and I'm quite sure you will be inspired. How you doing, my brother?
I'm doing pretty good. Thank you for having me.
All right, man. All right. So where did it all start, man? The Bronx, huh?
Yeah, the Bronx. The Bronx. I grew up 2125 Randall Avenue in the Bronx. We don't know if it's the South or Middle Bronx because of the way it sits, right? But it's really in the southern part of the Bronx. It's a housing project that you might think about. And it has all of the issues in that community you would think about. And somehow I wound up in my life being an engineer at one point and now a state senator. It's an amazing thing to be able to go from that place to where I sit today.
Right. So tell me about living in the Bronx, early short pants days.
I'm not that old that I wore short pants, but that's before my time. It's an interesting community. It's a black and Hispanic community.
Yes.
A lot of flavor that you would think would exist in that community and all of the troubles that existed in that community. And my mom, who was married to my father, but my father did things that a lot of our fathers in those communities do, found herself in a place where she was trying to raise three kids in a difficult community. So she focused heavily on the things that kids in those communities focus on, kids' mothers in those communities focus on, which is school and making sure that we move forward. And so we struggle with what was happening right where we were, but my mother was trying to put us in a place where we were doing better. So we never actually went to school right in our local neighborhood.
Mm.
We had a grandfather who lived, my father's father, who lived in Co-op City in the northern part of the Bronx.
Yes.
And like a lot of kids, when there's a better education somewhere else, we pretended like we lived in Co-op City with my grandfather.
Right.
And so during the day, I was a Co-op City resident. And in the afternoon and evening, I went back home into my community, which creates a weird kind of thing, right? Because you're of the community, but all your friends are outside that community. And so you don't really have a place where you really fit in completely. And so I grew up in this environment. My mother's trying to make sure that we don't have the outcome that many of the kids in the environment have. And that's the struggle until, I guess, I was, I went to high school at the High School of Art and Design. I got accepted there because in New York, you know, you have all of these specialized high schools.
Right.
And I did that for a year. And then my mother was fortunate enough to be able to have us move out to Long Island with my aunt. So we lived in my aunt's house. And I didn't want to commute back and forth every day to Manhattan. It was bad enough commuting from the Bronx to Manhattan. And so I went to high school at Westbury High School. Now, this was a revelation to me. Mm. You know, most of the kids grew up in a house. Many of them had a mother and father. They were closer to the middle class than we were. So it was a different experience. And when I got to Westbury, you know what those kids wanted to be? They wanted to be us back in the community I grew up in.
Wow.
Right? Because what they saw on TV, what they heard in music, said that that was cool. And I'm thinking to myself, we're trying to escape that. Mm. And here you are trying to pretend like you are that thing. So anyway, I was always a good student because of the emphasis in my house on education. So when I approached graduation of high school, I was ready for college. I was a student who didn't apply to any backup schools. I had 8 schools I applied to. I got into 7, and I was ready to go. And then I found out that my financial aid didn't make it to any of the schools. Mm. So it made it a little bit difficult for me to go to school. And so I was like, look, it's cool because I got accepted to these schools. I'll just apply again and go to the next year. I started working and life didn't go in that direction. Life took me into the military, which was a whole different story.
Right.
And that's really the beginning of my story.
Right.
So
I mean, a lot of folks always wonder, right, especially folks who have not lived you know, under the conditions that you lived in, myself, how did we get around it, right? You know, because, like, you know, when we talk about, you know, our lives, you know, especially, you know, your life, how did you get around the drugs and the gangs? And I mean, you know, what did you do to get around that?
Yeah, my father was a drug addict and an alcoholic. And for the beginning of my relationship with him, for the early part of my life, he was around. Mm. So I don't just know that he did those things. I saw what it was for him to be going through that. I also knew what it was because my father, the drug will compel you in ways that love for your children or your wife don't. And my father would oftentimes take me I'd be in the back of the car. Now you got to remember what Harlem was like back in these days, right?
Yes.
The Bronx wasn't looking so hot, but Harlem was a place you didn't want to be.
And what year was that?
So when I was very young, we're talking the late 70s, early 80s, right?
Yes,
so, you know, we're not talking. Harlem looks, I don't even know what Harlem is today.
Yeah, right.
But he would go down, I guess he had a supplier somewhere in Harlem. So he would go down to Harlem to get his drugs, and I'd be in the back of the car, left in the back of the car while he was getting his stuff.
Mm.
This stuff doesn't go away from you. These images, the treatment, all of these things don't go away from you.
Right.
And so while that stuff was in my environment, I was deathly afraid of it. I'm one of those people who can honestly say I've never touched a drug in my life because of my experience growing up. You know, people like, everybody smokes marijuana. I'm like, nah, not this guy.
Right. So fear drove you.
Absolute fear.
That's interesting.
Absolute paralyzing fear.
Yes.
It took me a long time to drink because I was like, if I touch the alcohol, I feel like it's in the blood. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like my grandfather liked to drink. Mm. My father had an alcohol problem, went through programs. I was afraid to touch drug or alcohol of any sort. I didn't care there was marijuana and everybody did it. I didn't care what it was. I was afraid to touch it. That, and I was also afraid of my mother. I'll be honest with you. 'Cause my mother was no joke. My mother would, you know, beat you down like an old school black mother.
Right.
So I was scared to death of it. And then I had something else going on for me. So, you know, I always say, things are in your life for a reason, even the negative things. So my father, with all the negativity that he brought into my life, and he did a lot of the stuff black fathers do, aside from the drug stuff, he did the stuff about trying to teach you to be a man in ways that don't actually teach you to be a man. They teach you to be angry and close off. And so he did that. And for years in my life, I had anger issues. You know, I was...
Can I hold you for 1 second? This is Juan Castillo. Speaking of Gary Winfield, Connecticut State Senator, and we're talking about his life, and you're probably saying, hey, whoa, if you just came in, right? You know what I mean? You know, but it goes to show you about people's journeys, right?
Yeah.
You know, and one of the things, you just mentioned that, right? I was talking to a young man the other day that, you know, was talking about, I said, how you doing, man? And he's like, yeah, man, you know, I'm doing all right. So he said, so I said, oh, yeah, really? Yeah, man, I got a couple of girls, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, I'm like, yo, really? So you bragging about that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, so he's like, yeah, you know, hey, Juan, I got to do my thing. I said, yeah, but, you know, like, don't you have trouble trying to date all three of these girls and your money getting tight,
right,
all of that? Yeah, but, you know, I'm a player, man, you know. And I tried to explain to him that, in fact, you know, like, part of the reason why we're not successful, you know, as black men sometimes, right, is because we're listening to that corner conversation about go out there and date a whole lot of different girls. And, you know, I went through it too now, you know what I'm saying? But I was listening to that, right? So that's kind of what you're talking about, right? Like, you know, like that kind of, you know, that kind of advice that if you're a man, you're running around there with a lot of women early in your life, right?
That and the way you act on the street.
So
in my house, I was a small kid, right?
Ain't small now, bro. You should see this boy. Anyway, go ahead.
I don't look small now. But the reason I am the way I am now is because I was small. I went to the gym and I was like, okay, I don't like people picking because everybody picked on me.
I hear you.
And so even in my politics, you'll know if somebody goes after somebody who doesn't deserve it, I tend to turn around and go after that person. But my father was someone who believed that a man was certain things and men didn't let anybody deal with them the wrong way. Men always spoke up for themselves. Men would fight when they needed to, or maybe even when they didn't need to. And so because I was small, when I was on the playground, you know what happens. Kids pick on the smallest kid. So I go home and my father would be like, no, it can't happen. No, you can't come in this house letting that happen. To the point where he actually locked the door on me sometimes. Mm. So in order for me to come back in the house, nobody can mess with me. And my mother used to tell a story, and this is what I'm talking about, anger issues. What happens is if you aren't physically able to do what is demanded of you, you become angry about it, right?
Yes, yes.
And so I became a vicious kid. I'm going to be honest with you. I became a vicious kid. And the story my mother always told was about this kid, Darren, who was on the playground. Took my basketball. 6'4" kid. I'm like 6 years or 7 years old, right? What are you going to do, even if you're not a small kid for your age?
Right.
Well, I'm going to tell you what I did, because by that point, I was already angry. I waited for him. And when he was sitting on the corner, I got a bottle and busted him upside the head and took my basketball.
Right.
And that's the way I functioned for a long time in my life, because I didn't know how else to do things. And I think sometimes we're trying to do the right thing by our kids, by teaching them that you can't let people do whatever they want to you. But we also have to give them a space to feel, to breathe, to cry as men.
Yes.
And we don't do that. And sometimes what we create in those young people is an anger that explodes in our community. Mm. And when you have a community full of people with that anger exploding, it's no wonder why you see the things you see, even in the better communities. Imagine, though, that happens in communities where people are compressed without opportunity.
Yes.
And that's why that kind of stuff is ingrained in the work that I've done in my life.
Juan Castillo, speaking with us, Connecticut State Senator Gary Winfield, we're talking about his life. So, I mean, in your own district, right? Yeah. You know, we're dealing with some issues about our youth and so forth. You know, you just covered one of those that, you know, you got a lot of fatherhood programs and folks are trying to really mentor young men to do the right thing and to not be murdering each other and so forth and so on, right? But, you know, like if you listen to people in New Haven and also outside of New Haven, you know, this is the worst place to live. You know, like, you know, I mean, getting into politics, you know, Donald Trump, you know, like,
you know, yeah, you can't walk down the street without getting
shot. We get shot, right? I don't get shot walking out of the street. Right, you know what I'm saying? You know, and, you know, but the reality of it all is that we do got a problem.
We
though,
do.
Right. We do have a problem. And how do you see, you know, how we make that better?
I think, so here's my thing.
Yes.
At the point at which I chose to live in the Ville,
yes.
Right, the Ville wasn't what it is today. I'm right. not saying the Ville is perfect, but it's a lot different than it was even 5, 6, 7, 8 years right. ago. And when I moved in, this is what I heard, not from white people, but from black people. Why are you moving into the Ville?
Mm-hmm.
And it blew my mind. I was like, why can't I move anywhere, first of all? Why wouldn't I move anywhere? And why wouldn't I want to be in a place where I'm around people who I recognize, right? I recognize people like the people I grew up with. But the difference is that I'm not that person that I was, that I have gone out, I've learned things. I've gone out and I've become things. And I can bring that into the community to help the community be all it can be. I'm not saying the community needs Gary, but I'm saying the community needs us not to leave it.
Yes.
And then sit on the outside of the community and criticize. What I can do inside that community is be Gary, the state rep or state senator who's in the community, so that the kids in the community actually have a relationship with Gary where they don't say, oh, he came to my school and I saw this dude and maybe someday I might be able to be like him. When you see somebody every day, that's just normal.
Or live in Brantford.
Right. Or Brantford, right?
And that's real.
Right.
I mean, I lived in Brantford and I raised my daughter in Brantford for the better opportunities. It's like your mom took you to Long Island, right? But I came back home.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I'm right around the corner from you.
Right.
So, but it was like I had to make a conscious decision to realize that my neighborhood needed me, but I also needed to be comfortable. Because, right. And that's real. You know what I'm saying?
Listen, I don't say this to say to everybody that leaves, there's a problem with you because you left.
True.
I understand why people leave. But some of us have to recognize that we're doing the same things that we get upset with white folks about, right?
Mm.
We look at the neighborhood and we automatically say that neighborhood is this thing or that thing or that thing. We haven't even been in a neighborhood, some of us. Right. So how do you know what the neighborhood is?
Right.
You spent no time in a neighborhood, but you're quick to have something to say about the neighborhood.
Right.
And so my thing was this. At the time when I first got to New Haven, I was in engineering. right? I made a lot of money. Life was really good. Mm-hmm. And I was living in Audubon Court.
Yes.
I think at the time I was the only person of color actually owning an Audubon Court. They thought, honestly, and this is not a joke, it sounds like a joke, they thought I was a drug dealer.
Mm.
Right? But when I decided I was running for office, my thing was, where should I be? Because if I'm going to be somebody who's going to be helping people, do I need to be at Audubon Court? Or should I better be closer to where people are? And my decision, partially because of my life experience, is to be where people are. Because you know what I heard when I walked around New Haven knocking on doors? Oh, man, here you guys come. It's election time. You come in knocking on doors. Y'all don't come around unless it's election time. And I was like, you know, that's true. But it's also funny to me because the neighborhood I grew up in, it didn't matter if it was election time. They didn't even come then.
Right.
And that's a powerful thing to know.
Yes.
And so my thing was like, I'm going to take this out of your hands to tell me that we don't come around because I live right next to you. Mm. I can't. I got to come around every day because I got to go. I got to leave for work in the morning.
Right.
And I got to come back to go to sleep at night.
Right.
And, you know, look, the thing is, people were like, this brother moved in. He's going to move out in about 3 years after he gets the office. You know, I'm almost 10 years deep now in that same place.
Right.
And to me, it's a beautiful place to live because I have neighbors who I talk to. I have kids who I see in the morning when I stand out there with my stepson waiting for the bus. And they see me and I interact with them. If they do something silly, I'm like, listen, pick up the trash. You know what I mean? And I talk to them, how you doing this morning? Have a great day. And they have somebody every single day of school that's talking to them, that's an adult.
Well, in the last 10 years, we've gone from New Hallville being the epicenter of the housing crisis with all kinds of, you know, foreclosures to now it's almost moving into a little gentrification for that matter, right?
Yes.
However, people don't drive through New Hallville to see all the new homes and how the neighborhood has changed in 10 years. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's to your point that you mentioned earlier, that people just have this attitude about a particular neighborhood. Notion. Exactly, you know. And so let's get back a little bit to, you took a year off after high school and you went into the Navy.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
So, again, I got into a whole bunch of schools, but I didn't have any money. And so I decided I was going to work for a year. And then go back to school, go reapply and go back. If you can get in, you can get in, right? So that was my thing. But then I realized I had a sister who was a year behind me in school. And with the way things were working with my mother's money, even with the financial aid, I wasn't sure I was going to be able to make it. And I didn't want to start school and not be able to make it. And so I just did what I thought was a good sacrifice. I figured I thought of myself as more resilient than my sister in some ways. So I said, listen, I'll go into the military. You can go to college. She never finished college. So, you know, I don't forget that,
but I
went into the military and I went into the Navy's nuclear power program. Again, a program where there are not a lot of people of color, but that was a good thing. At least I thought it was, that was a good thing, because it opens opportunities when you're one of a few.
Right.
Now it turns out, race is a factor in everything. And I had issues because of my race in that program. And actually, at one point, there was an effort to get me out of the program. Fortunately, I was able to survive. But I did that. And then when I left the Navy, I worked for a company called Alstom Power. And you may remember in the late 90s and the early 2000s, there was a project going up, Milford Power Project.
Mm-hmm.
And I was one of the electrical field advisors on the installation of the electrical systems, and at one point even the construction manager of the electrical systems. So that's how I actually wound up here in Connecticut.
Right. Juan Castillo, I'm speaking with our Connecticut State Senator Gary Winfield. We're talking about his life, and you know, we just finished discussing you know, his stint in the Navy. How did politics creep into your life?
Yeah, so when I got here in 2000, you know, I like to kind of know where I live. And I walked around New Haven, and my honest assessment, and this is an assessment based on very little information, actually, but it's just a walk through the city. My honest assessment was that the people who control politics must be white, because if they were of color, you wouldn't have a city to function the way it did.
Mm.
That was my assessment.
In two separate cities.
Right. So once I realized they weren't, I said, there's a problem here. And it was a part of me that wanted to have something to do with changing that.
Yes.
But I was at the power plant working 15 hours a day, and so there was a struggle. right? How do you work 15 hours a day and get involved? Well, that got solved by the fact that I did a really good job at the power plant. My company wanted me to go to Arkansas to fix a broken power plant. Now, I was married at the time, so my ex-wife was like, yeah, you can go to Arkansas, but we aren't going to Arkansas. And so that solved my problem, because if we weren't going to Arkansas, I wasn't going to Arkansas.
Right.
So I went back, tried to negotiate with the company. They had reimagined what I did. They thought, you know, you're going to do this work like what they wanted me to do, and I didn't want to do that. We went back and forth, and finally we separated ways. So I had a nice separation from them. I was able to live for a little while, a couple of years, and I had free time. So now all of the stuff that I wanted to get involved in, I had no reason not to get involved in. So I went back to school, worked on a degree at Southern in political science, and just started inserting myself into stuff going on around New Haven. And I was one of those people who just didn't know how to stick to one or two issues. I went inserted myself in everything.
Right.
Right. So I was like the guy in the back who nobody knew, who's like, yeah, we're talking about education in New Haven. He's just sitting in the back. We're talking about criminal justice in New Haven. He's sitting in the back. Even before it was something that black people wanted to do. Oh, we're talking about the rights of same-sex couples. And I was sitting over there, and people were just like, what? And then I actually had people say to me, listen, you can't do that. You got to pick a place to go and deal with that issue.
Right.
And it's like, I do? No, I don't. My free time is my free time. I can give it as much as I want. But having talked and been in all of these different places, you become a connection. And so over time, as I got more comfortable speaking and doing things, you know, I was a part of a lot of different groups, and I became an activist on issues. And when I went to school, I had to do a political science internship, and this is where I met Bill Dyson. Mm-hmm. So he was the person I did the internship with. I think Dyson kind of liked my spirit, because I kind of one of those people who's like, I'm going to say what I'm going to say.
Right.
Right. And, you know, maybe I shouldn't say it, but but we developed a kind of connection. And so in 2007, before the 2008 race, he said to me, he said, look, you should run. I'm not running. You should run. And by that time, I was full-fledged activist. So I'm looking at Dyson. I'm like, listen, I love you. From my perspective, you're awesome. But I yell at people like you.
Right.
I try to push people like you. And I try to give him more. He's like, yeah, no, I know. But the problem is, if you're always on the outside doing that, how do you ever get the people you want inside? And I really had, like, I was sitting there like, I don't have an answer for this man.
Mm.
And because I didn't have an answer, I'm running for state representative.
Right.
And I'm kind of like, how the heck did I go from trying to work in this engineering field to running for political office?
Right.
And that's how it began.
Right. You know, one of the things, you know, we got, you know, we have, you know, we have a an election that's coming up here in November. And, you know, one of the issues that has been sort of put on the table that I think is extremely important, and you probably have seen some of my posts on Facebook in regard to campaign financing.
Mm-hmm.
I think you were at one of an event when I spoke to some kids about how important that was. And when you're thinking about, you know, voting for someone, look at who is giving them money for campaign. Now, what do you think of this idea? I just want to throw it out at you, right? I believe that there should be public financing, and that's it. I believe there should be public financing, and that, and I also believe, now, people in radio probably will think I'm crazy, because there's a lot of money that goes into political, you know, into political ads, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I think that since we have a our license says that we're supposed to be serving the community, that we should give share and equal time to people that are running, and that way for free. So then that way, you're not running around trying to raise money in order for you to put some ads in, right? And now what that does is that you don't have to get in bed with all these companies that want to have some, you know, some clout with you when a bill comes up that is going to benefit them or not benefit them, right? What do you think?
I think campaign financing reform in Connecticut, I start there.
Yes.
I think it has been very impactful. I think it has changed the way that politics work at the state level.
Yes.
First of all, I couldn't have run without campaign finance reform.
Okay.
I never could have run up against, at the time it was Charles Blango who was running for state representative. I never could have run because I wouldn't have been able to raise any money.
Right.
Right? Because I spent all of my time focused on just doing my community activism. I wasn't focused on building the networks that would have money and all of those things. So the people that I was working with and working for didn't have any money. So if I wanted to run, it would be like, well, yeah, nice of the that's a great thing, but like, how are you going to get the money? So having a campaign finance reform system evens the playing field, right? You have an incumbent or someone who's backed by a political party who can get to the whatever the requirements are, but somebody who could come out of the clear blue can make those requirements. And now once the money's equal, it becomes about ideas.
Yes.
It also takes out of play those people who are lobbyists who will be giving you the big bucks. So lobbyists don't give me money. You right. know what lobbyists can give me in the state of Connecticut? Information. And the way that you have influence is whether you give me good information or not.
Right.
That's what it is. So I think campaign finance reform just in general is important. Now, are we going to have a system of campaign finance reform where you completely take out the rich guy's ability to use his money? No, because the way that the Supreme Court has talked about money is akin to speech. And speech, you have a right. You have a right of free speech. So you're going to have a right for your own personal money forever to, I mean, unless some new decision, which isn't coming, comes, to spend your money.
But that's been a big issue.
It's a big issue. But if you had a system like Connecticut or designed to think in ways the Connecticut system is designed to think,
yes.
you would have a fundamental change to our political system
right.
because you would depower some people and empower some people. And let me tell you one of the things that's most important about the system we have, and I'm passionate about this because I've been a speaker nationally on these issues.
Yes.
The way Connecticut system is designed, there's a number of people you have to get in order to hit the threshold, and there's a dollar amount you have to get.
Mm.
Total in the aggregate. But that dollar amount is raised in between $5 and $100. So because I have to get the number, let's say I had to get to, I'm going to make up numbers here, right?
Yeah.
Let's say I had to get to $1,000 and I had $999 or $995, right? And I need to get five more dollars even though I have, you know, everything else, right? Well, a $5 contribution actually gets me over that threshold.
Mm-hmm.
Or let's say I needed to get, 200 people. Well, as long as you give me the minimum, you count as one of those people, right? So, because I need both parts. So the little old lady who has $5 or $10, she becomes important in ways she never was.
Right.
And so now I'm going to give her some time. And I'm going to hear her ideas in ways that, look, under the old system, I would not talk to you if you had $100.
Mm.
Right, but under the system we have, I'm going to talk to you because I need your $5, $10, $15, $20, whatever you have, in order for me to make it. So now I'm hearing things I never would hear.
Right.
And in the next election, I got to go back and get another $5 from you.
Right.
So I'm not going to forget about you.
Right.
And that's what makes the system so much better. Now, is it perfect? Of course not.
Yes.
But it's a better system. And I think campaign finance, this is why I like Bernie. I was a Bernie supporter. I was that guy. I was that politician who right. actually came out and said, I don't care what the system is doing.
Right.
I'm with Bernie. And I was with Bernie. I liked all of the stuff he was talking about. But the thing that brought me in was campaign finance
yes.
reform.
Yes.
And so if you're talking to me about it, I'm with you.
Right.
Right. And the question is, how do we get other people to be with you? Because there's an interest in not doing what you and I want to do.
Exactly. I think the thing about this election that's striking for the African-American community is they're talking about us. You know, for the first time, our vote is needed
yeah.
really, really, really badly, yeah. right? You know, by both parties, mm-hmm. right? You know? And, we still haven't been able to get to a point where we can ask for what we want.
Well, I think we can ask for it. I'm just waiting for us to do so.
Right? Go ahead.
Look, you know, whether we're talking about the national election or here, look, I'm just going to be real because I don't care what people think and people get upset with me all the time. I don't understand how people get elected and people don't ask anything from them and then turn around and say, look. You didn't do what I wanted you to. You didn't actually ask for anything. This is what I tell people all the time. Look, people are only going to do what they have to do. And so I had a conversation the other day, and I've been having a conversation where my conversation is about this. I don't care about the conversation about speaking truth to power. That conversation is nonsense to me. Power doesn't respect your truth.
Mm.
What power respects is more power. So I want to have a conversation where I'm speaking power to power.
Mm.
Right? You have to listen to me.
Right.
And they do, but we don't know it. So in the state of Connecticut, and then I'll get to the national election, I won't forget your question.
Right.
In the state of Connecticut, in order to be the governor, you got to go through a couple of cities. Right? You have to.
Exactly.
And you go through those cities, and what do those cities get in return? Now, they were going to get something from you anyway, because you need those cities to keep moving. So that can't be what they got from you. They got to get something special.
Right.
And so what I'm saying to people is this. Look, I don't know about the rest of y'all, but what I want to know in 2018, when the next gubernatorial race comes up and they come to those same cities, New Haven being one of them, is what are we getting in return? Why doesn't the top of the ticket have whoever you want at the top, but why can't the person who's second, the lieutenant governor, be a woman of color?
Mm.
Right? And right. Don't tell me about what your rules are, how it has to happen, because we know when we want things to happen, they happen how we want them
right.
to happen.
Right.
And I need you to want us to diversify that ticket, because I don't want to hear this conversation about, well, you know, we know it can happen. I don't know. I don't believe. I'm not that kind of person. I don't believe it till I see it.
Mm.
And so what I'm saying is, if you want something and they need something from you, extract that from them. And that's not what we do. We go, well, we got to have a Democrat in office. We got to have a this in office. We got to have a that in office. I don't have to have that in office, because no matter who's in office, my community ain't getting.
And that's really what it's about. I mean, I think that by the end of the day, you know, you got Hispanics that ask for what they want.
Mm-hmm.
You got gays that ask for what they want. And on and on and on. You got the corporations that ask for what they want. And I think that as African-Americans, you know, we have to get to the point where it's like, okay, you know what? Like, I know we died for our votes, you know, to vote,
mm-hmm.
right? But, like, what is, put a value on it besides just going right. to vote, right? I mean, one of the things that I've heard all along is, you know, we're in a position where you have to vote for the lesser of two evils, right? You know, like, in fact, no other parties are relevant except for the Democratic and the Republican Party. And there's other parties that are relevant, and they are sending out a message.
Right.
So that is not the case. What's your thoughts?
Let me just say, I think that unfortunately, right now you're in a position where it really is the lesser of two evils. And let me say why I think that is. I think that's because the work to build up those other parties doesn't happen.
Mm.
Right? So you can't start in August of the year of the election to build what should have been built in the intervening 4 years.
Mm.
So what's going to happen is this. You have Gary Johnson and Jill Stein as the other two candidates that people know, and then all the people that nobody even knows, right,
right.
who are running for president. And people are going to tell me, oh, you know, if only. And then when the election's over, all the if onlys are going to go away. They're going to go about their life. And then 4 years from now, they're going to have two candidates in a Democrat and a Republican who they don't really think are speaking to their issues. They're going to have these alternative parties who are going to get 1-5% of the vote. And they're going to have the same conversation because they haven't done anything in the interim.
Mm.
You can't go away for 4 years and think you're going to have an alternative. So it's not because, I mean, the Democrats and the Republicans, they have power. Nobody's giving up the power. If you want power, you have to go take the power. And that means you have to do some work. You can't just hope. Look, if Jill Stein hadn't come along, what would you be doing?
Right.
I mean, and I'm not just talking about Jill Stein. I'm talking about anywhere on a local level. Look, if you want to win an automatic race in the city of New Haven, what's the number? What's the number you need?
Mm.
Sometimes it's 72.
Right.
I mean, we got houses in New Haven where people got 8 people in the house and you can't get to 72.
Right. It's amazing.
You haven't done the work and you can't start right before the election talk about I don't like the choices I have.
Right.
So what are you doing to get involved? What are you doing? And I understand some people, I don't have time. You don't have time for them to be doing what they're doing either.
Right.
So at some point you have to say, this is important enough that I have to stop doing something else. So that I can do this because my life is important, and I can't put I can't trust my life to people who I have no reason to trust.
And so, what you're saying, by the way, everybody, I'm talking to Gary Winfield, you know, Connecticut State Senator here, representing us here in New Haven, and you know, it's interesting because you know, by the end of the day, you know, what you're talking about is, you know, is the work is not just getting up on election day and then going to vote. And what are you doing the rest of the time?
Right.
Right. I mean, it's just like, you know, if you only go see your kid's teacher, you know, during, you know, teacher parents conferences, mm-hmm. you know, and then all of a sudden you just find out that your kid is failing when, in fact, you could have a conversations, mm-hmm. plural, with the teacher for the, you know, the whole semester.
Oh, yeah.
Right. You know, and that's what you're saying.
Yeah, I'm saying that I understand how difficult it is for people to do some of the stuff I'm talking about.
Yes.
But what is more difficult is to live in the place where you live in the way that you're living in that place.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in a, here's the thing. And I listen to Eric Thomas, his motivational speaker. He motivates me all the time. I listen to him every week. Eric says, if you're in a place of pain, you got nowhere but to go but up out of that pain.
Mm.
And even though the first action is going to be painful, hell, you're already in pain. So what's the problem?
Right.
We live in, people of color in this country have lived in pain. So yes, the first actions to move out of that pain are painful and difficult. And, you know, there's some growing to do and it's not what we do. I get it.
Right.
But the only place to go is up out of that pain. And that's what I'm talking about. And if you're not talking about going up out of that pain, I'm not going to say anything negative about you, but get the hell out of my way.
Mm.
Because I've been blessed in my life to have some things happen. And I think I have some abilities that can help me bring some other people out of pain. So even if you don't like what I'm doing, unless you're doing something, move out of the way.
Right.
That's
right.
What I'm saying.
Juan Castillo, which we've been speaking with Gary Winfield, Connecticut State Senator. Police brutality.
Yeah.
Right. It continues to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, we continue to talk about the good cops. There's a few bad cops, but at the foundation of it all, it's about the individual cop or cops that approach the job from a biased perspective, mm-hmm. right? And you know, there's been a lot of conversation about, well, how do you change that, right? You got any ideas?
So I don't want to have a conversation about good versus bad cops.
Yes.
It's a systemic problem, and a conversation about good versus bad cops is not a systemic conversation.
Mm.
And so I look at this system and all systems and say we all enter the system with biases.
Yes.
In some places, those biases will matter, and in other places they don't. Sometimes it has to do with the fact that if you're biased and you act upon your bias, there's a punishment.
Yes.
Well, we've seen all kinds of things happen to people of color in this country. You shoot them dead in the streets, and there's no punishment for it.
Mm.
So my bias isn't going to cause me any trouble. That's one place you start. There's got to be a punishment, which is why in 2015 we did what was called the body cam bill, but it was also a police accountability bill.
Yes.
Because we were tired of people telling us about, oh, you know, it's good cop versus bad. I don't care. All cops should be doing what they're supposed to do. And if you're not, there should be a punishment. Now, did the bill we do, was it a panacea? Did it fix everything? No. But the country needs to be moving to a place where police officers realize, look, we appreciate the work you do, but you should be as accountable as anybody else for the things that you do.
Right.
And so this is what we need to do. And here, the reality is, look, there should be repercussions, not just for the police officer, but for the people who are above the police, the chief, the mayor. Right? All these people have something to do with what that person on the beat does.
Mm.
In my city, you don't get to do this. In my municipality, you don't get to do this. And if that person shoots and kills somebody in an unjustified way, not only does that person get the consequence, hell, mayor, you got to go.
Mm.
Unless you're out there doing the things that a mayor won't do, because it's difficult to do. It's difficult for a mayor, even when we can look with our own eyes and see something wrong happen, to come out and say, that's wrong.
Right.
Because you have to deal with the police and the police union and all of the sentiment around police. But what I'm saying is we have to require something better. And what I think is most important is this conversation about community policing.
Mm-hmm.
It irks me to no end. And I know this is not popular.
Okay.
But it irks me because that conversation is a cop-out. And here's why it's a cop-out. You go to a white community, it's safe. You don't see cops. You don't see any cops. And when something happens and they come in their community, they don't shoot people.
Right.
They don't treat people like they're not human beings. They treat them like they live in the community, like they're human beings, and they don't need training to do it.
Mm.
But in our community, in order for them to do it, they have to have community policing so they're already understanding who we are. What that means is that community still is under siege by police. Now, they're nicer about it. But the community is still inundated with police.
That's interesting.
And what that really is a cop-out for the people in politics who have not done their job. It is economic conditions that create what's going on in those communities. It is redlining, whether it was actually happening, actual redline, or just happening because we kind of look at each other and go, yeah, I know.
Right.
Right? That is why those communities are the way they are. So the way that you fix that is not to put police in there, whether they're handing out candy, saying hello, or busting you upside the head. It doesn't matter. That's not the fix. That is a temporary bandage that says, I, as a politician, don't have to do my job. And it's unacceptable. And I want to know why we don't have leaders saying that. Why do we have leaders getting up and saying, oh, we got community policing. Hallelujah. We're ready to go. Look across the – look, I live at the bottom of the hill, right? Winchester Avenue. You go up the hill – Prospect, and you go down, you're in a white community. You don't see police doing what you see them doing in my community.
That's true.
That's a fact. People don't have to like what I'm saying. It's a fact. And we need leaders who are willing to say what is true and go back to the governors, the mayors, the local politicians, the state politicians, and say, what in the world are you doing?
Right. Well, there you have it. Juan Castillo with you, man. Got Gary Winfrey Hill, Connecticut State Senator. Man, it's been a pleasure having you here, brother. You
know, I enjoyed it.
Breath of fresh air, brother, you know. And, you know, before you leave, man, what's the best advice you ever gotten from who?
You know, I thought about trying to answer that question. I think it's advice I've gotten over and over again that you already know what you need to do.
Yes.
Just do it. Most of us have a hard time doing what we know we need to do. And, you know, how much time do we have? Because I want to tell a quick
story.
Go on.
We got time. Go ahead.
So... my mother, I tell a story, and I'm not going to cry today. I usually cry. My mother died in 2012.
Yes.
Her name was Araminta. She was a child of Harriet, who was a child of Araminta. Mm-hmm. Now, those names don't just necessarily mean things to people because you don't make certain connections. But we know a woman named Harriet Tubman, who was Araminta Ross, right? And so to my mother, in the moment before she died, you know, we were talking, not right before she died, but shortly before she died, we were talking. My mother said to me that she wished she could do the things that I was doing in life, going and helping people and all of that stuff. And I'm like, what? And she said she knew she hadn't done all the stuff she wanted to. She felt like a failure. Now, I'm her son. I'm sitting there and I'm like, that hit you like,
right?
And I'm like, I don't know how to respond. So I'm just like, yeah. What I realize now is that my mother did a lot of important stuff because she made me who I am.
Yes.
Right. Without my mother, I couldn't be who I am. Even though we think of ourselves as individuals, we rely on the story of those who came before, particularly our parents. And so my mother's story is that she recognized the connection of the name, Araminta and Harriet. And what she gave to me was this thing about you already know what to do. But what I already knew to do was what she believed in, which was the work of Harriet. Which was to go back and get those who were left behind. Because Harriet said when she got free, she wasn't really free because she had friends and family left behind.
Yes.
And she couldn't be free until they were free. And so my work in life is the work of none of us are free until all of us are free. And so my mother and others put that into me. So the best advice I ever got was that advice. To recognize that you might be free. You might have gotten out of that housing project in the Bronx. You might have been able to escape some of what it is to be of color in this community because you have economic status. But until everybody's free, you aren't really free.
Right.
And that's my thing.
Thank you, brother.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming, man.
Absolutely.
Juan Castillo with you. I know you've been inspired. I have. This is the Electric Drum. We will see you next week.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.